on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking the 70th anniversary of VE Day by listening to one of the men who might have died in captivity if the Allies had not driven the Nazis back and eventually achieved victory in Europe. Glenn Schmidt is his name.
Glenn is a World War II veteran who served in the Air Force after World War II, but you heard him tell you that he was with the 42nd Rainbow Division as a BAR man wielding a Browning automatic rifle in Europe during World War II. I also mentioned that he was a prisoner of war, so we're going to get the story of how he was captured. But before that, Glenn, why don't you tell me the story of how you ended up with a couple of bullet holes in your helmet?
Well, one night early in January 1945, my squad was selected to reestablish a listening post about a half a mile away from where I had been quartered. We were in the old Maginot Line, which was built by the French prior to World War II to effect fortifications against the Germans who might attack them, which they had years before. These fortifications were right near the Rhine River, just to the west of the river, north and south of the city of Strasbourg, way up and not much south.
And these Germans that you were fighting, now,
yes.
You've told us how you guys were just thrown together from all kinds of different outfits because they needed replacements.
Yes.
The guys you're fighting against hadn't been fighting for the Germans for years on the Russian front. They'd fought in that kind of weather before, the worst
yes.
winter that Europe had ever seen. So when you take all those things into account, it sounds like a bit of a mismatch here.
It really was. We did not realize that the 21st and 25th SS Panzer Divisions, infantry as well as running brand new Mark VI Tiger tanks, many of them flame-throwing tanks. This is what we were up against, although we did not realize it. My outfit replaced the 79th Division, which had been on the line for some time. They had pushed the Germans back across the Rhine, and at this time, the 1st of January 1945, this group had just recently come down from the Russian-Finnish border and grouped along the river and crossed it unknown to us.
So it was a bit of a surprise situation when
yes.
you guys were fired upon.
Yes. Well, the night of the 8th of January, when we were selected to reestablish a listening post, we didn't know where we were going. However, 10 or 12 of us, I don't recall exact number, because some of our men had been taken out at Christmas time to be as replacements to the 90th Division, which had lost quite a number of men. It so happened that 90th Division was
your
along
brother
the line
was in
my,
that division.
My brother was a replacement to that division also. Yes. And, of course, I did not know that he was overseas until I returned home. He didn't know I was a prisoner until I returned home.
But this night that you're fired on,
yes.
You guys are in your olive drab, which is
yes,
easy
sir.
To spot against the snow, if there's any kind of illumination. The Germans are in all white, even with white sheets over their head?
They used pillowcases on their helmets and either had white capes on, and their boots were whitewashed as well. Very difficult to see at night and almost impossible to see during the day unless they moved.
Tell me about the moment that you realized you were under attack.
Well, we were to establish a listening post where some of our men had been hit and driven back several hours before during the daylight hours. This was well after dark. I don't recall the time, but I estimated it to be about 9 o'clock in the evening. We were crawling along on the open snow with about 2.5 feet of snow on the ground and still snowing. And I was crawling with cradling my BAR in my arms. There was one man in front of me, I was the second one, and the balance of the men were behind me. Also at this coming up, taking up the rear was our squad leader as well as our platoon leader. The squad leader was a man by the name of Lentz, and the platoon leader was a man by the name of Jim Beers. However, on the way up, things got very quiet. There had been some scattered firing around us, but not significant enough. And then it just seemed like all hell broke loose. Scattered firing from the right and the left, and way up ahead of us, maybe 75 to 100 yards ahead of us, bullets were flying all around us. And naturally, they used a number of tracers, and I could see the tracers coming right at me, just almost directly at me. And some hit on the snow beside me to my right. I could not tell exactly where they were going, so I turned my head, looked around, and they ricocheted on up into the air above the pillbox that was directly behind us, maybe 300 to 400 yards. At that time, a man by the name of Harold L. Finley from Ohio, the man in front of me, was killed instantly by the machine gun fire. I did not know it at the time. However, he did not move, and after I tried to reach him and tug on him, I saw that he had been killed. Shortly thereafter, two Germans came up on a little wooden bridge about 75 feet in front of us with a machine gun. And as I was able to knock both of them down with my BAR, within a minute, three more came up, and they got the machine gun on firing on automatic. It was bouncing up and down with tracers going everywhere.
It was out of control. They weren't firing. It was firing.
Yes, it was firing, but it was out of control because I had dropped those other three men as well.
So even while you're under fire and your friend is killed, you're doing your part, you're doing your job, you're taking out these Germans, but this uncontrolled German machine gun is still firing bullets, and they're heading your way.
Yes, they were. And since then, I have taken my family back there, and the railing on this little bridge still has bullet holes in it. It was made out of angle iron, mm-hmm. and their bullet impacts and holes still in that in the railing over that bridge.
And that's all your fault?
Oh, yeah, I guess that's all my fault.
I think the statute of limitations is up. I don't think the bridge owners are going to come after you.
No, sir.
But speaking of bullet holes,
yes.
Shortly thereafter, you ended up with a couple in your helmet. How close did that come to ending your life?
Well, if you could see the helmet, a bullet hole comes in the front and exits the rear, being deflected by the liner that I wore. My helmet was knocked off, and I was wearing a wool knit cap. I lost my cap, and in trying to put another clip in my rifle, I had to take off my gloves because my hands were so cold. I could not take another clip out of my belt and insert it in the rifle. And my hands were so cold, I could not get them around two grenades that I had in my field jacket, because I was close enough. I thought if I could just toss a grenade in there, I'd be okay under the bridge. I'd be okay, because Germans were on both sides of that creek and on a little road to our right, maybe just a few yards from me, that crossed this little wooden bridge that these Germans were up on.
But your hands were so numb, you weren't very confident that you could avoid blowing yourself up with one of those grenades.
Definitely. Yes, sir.
But and you couldn't get your helmet back on your head because the liner had been moved aside by that bullet. That better that it move your liner than end your life. But you decided to carry the helmet with you.
Well, I felt it had saved my life once. It might save my life a second time. But when I put it on my head, it wouldn't fit because the straps inside my helmet liner had been lengthened to accommodate a wool knit cap over my head. So the only recourse I had was to carry the helmet back with me, which I did.
And how long was it from that instance to when you were actually captured and that your group of men was surrendered to the Germans?
We held out, according to the presidential unit citation, which our regiment received, we held out for 52 hours. Each time, and all this time, I was helping care for wounded, and I was assisting the best I could. We relinquished all the ammunition that we had, every bit of it, to fellows that were out in foxholes. And when we were finally captured, I had no ammunition at all to fight with.
And that's got to be a pretty helpless feeling.
You can't fight without adequate protection. You can't fight off tanks with rifles and machine guns.
And when your group was surrendered to the Germans, you were inside a pillbox?
Yes, sir. I was sitting directly behind my company commander. His name was William A. Corson. He was one brave man in my estimation. Captain Corson was asked by a sergeant, the 3rd Platoon sergeant, and by one lieutenant that was with him to surrender, because the day before we had seen those Mark VI Tiger tanks fire their flame-throwing ability at the pillboxes on up the line. They could not get to us because of that little wooden bridge. They didn't dare try to cross it. I had learned that, or had been told that it had been blown by our mortar people, but I'm not too sure about that.
So the question they asked Corson was, can we surrender now, right?
Well, yes, sir. At that time, the Germans had blown in the steel door with a Panzerfaust, which was like a Bangalore torpedo or like a, it was a heavy explosive that they used against tanks, and blew in the steel door, killed a number of fellows that were immediately on the inside. I was taking care of the wounded. Our company commander had been severely wounded the day before. He lost his right eye. There were shrapnel all over his face, his right side, and his shoulders, clear down on top of him. And when the Germans came up on top and dropped grenades down through the vent holes, it was like sticking your head in the steel drum and somebody pounding on it with a sledge. We had no alternative in order to get out, since we had no ammunition. The sergeant and the lieutenant tried to convince Captain Corson to surrender. Otherwise, they had handheld that they could have thrown in on us, and we'd all been incinerated. However, Captain Corson said, and I'm sitting right behind him, he said, you can surrender if you want to, but you don't have my permission. That took an awful lot of courage, a lot of guts.
And obviously that stuck with you all these years.
It has.
He had so little regard for his own life.
That's correct.
And so much love for his country.
Yes.
I suppose, and the cause.
If I can make one more comment.
Mm-hmm.
The last transmission that came on our 300 radio from regimental or battalion headquarters, I don't know which, was hold the line at all costs. I heard that, and it rang in my ears. I thought to myself, well, I'm part of that cost.
Mm-hmm.
And we all were.
Well, there's a terrific documentary called Hold at All Costs. It's actually about the Korean War and Outpost Harry within that war. And the way that turned out, a lot of them were part of the cost. And so many stories from World War II have that same thing. But Hold at All Costs, that's not a very encouraging thing to hear, because that means you ain't coming home.
Yes.
But you're here talking to me, so we know that you did make it home. And we need to take another break right here. But when we come back, we're going to talk about what kept Glenn going through his time as a prisoner of war, and another close call that he experienced before he was taken prisoner, and the incredible twist that his story took years after World War II. You won't want to miss it.
The rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.